Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Nachhalt-Podcasts vom Nachhaltigkeitsbüro der HU. Heute wieder mit dem neuesten Vortrag aus unserer Ringvorlesungsreihe Der grüne Faden. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören!
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I would like to begin by acknowledging any Indigenous people tuning in to this presentation, including those who may be listening to the recording at a later date. Thank you for being here. You are seen and valued. I would also like to acknowledge the First People of the land I currently reside on. Corvallis, Oregon is the traditional homeland of the Kalapuya people, whose living descendants reside today as citizens of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians and Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. Both are federally recognized tribes in and near the coastal mountain range of Western Oregon, and they are each comprised of several tribes and bands of people with unique experiences, cultures, and stories who today work together as unified tribal nations in a post-colonial state. Very quickly, thank you so much for the wonderful introduction already. But again, in case anyone's listening to this recording later, my name is Coral Avery. I use they, them, or they, she pronouns. I'm a Shawnee tribal citizen of Shawnee and mixed European descent and grew up in Kumeyaay lands of Southern California, around San Diego area, and currently reside on Kalapuya lands of Oregon in Corvallis, Oregon. I'm a first generation college student, meaning I'm the first in my family to go to college and to get a college degree. I was also a transfer student, so I started in a community college before going to university and graduated in the class of 2020. As was mentioned, also studied at the University of Tübingen in 2018 for the SOMA semester, and currently work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the Tribal Climate Resilience Program and with the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center. So to give a better idea of the geographic area that I'm going to be discussing today, I wanted to include this map. I've included the link at the bottom of the slide. It's just native-land.ca. And this is a really great interactive map to look at the territories of different Indigenous groups, the language spread of different Indigenous groups, as well as treaties within the Americas. And it's not a complete map, but it's growing in that direction. And I highly encourage everybody to use it. With this map, I wanted to show that Indigenous people exist across the globe, but I will be focusing on the Americas, particularly within the United States. And you'll see these little arrows on the left side of the map, including Alaska, Hawaii, Guam, and other US territories. And then some background information before I really dive into this. I know I'm giving this presentation in English, but this is also a topic that I'm sure many haven't heard much about. So some of the words, concepts, or locations that I'm discussing may be a little bit difficult to understand due to language or cultural barriers. Please write down your questions, save them for the end, and ask me all of them. I'm super excited to hear what everybody thinks and help expand on the topics that we'll be discussing. I'll also mention that the phrase Native American or Indian will only be used when referring to US law or policy. Otherwise, I'll use the terms Indigenous, Native, tribes, or the name of a specific tribal nation or Indigenous community, such as Cherokee Nation or Shawnee Tribe. I will also be speaking from my perspectives within my own identities and life experiences, not on behalf of any group. Indigenous people of North America are not a conglomerate. We hold many different Native identities, including our language, culture, religion, politics, identity within tribal nations, geography, history, and many more factors. And my experiences differ vastly even from those within my own tribe. There will be a lot of information shared today. So again, please ask questions, save them for later. I will be sharing resources at the end as well for some further learning and can add on to it before these slides are given out. And yes, these slides will be provided for everyone. And lastly, I'd like to warn you that some of the topics may be difficult to hear. I will be discussing some of the physical and cultural genocide that Indigenous people have faced within the US. And with that, I will now begin by discussing some of the colonized history of the country. So there's a very long history of Indigenous people in the Americas before European colonization. Indigenous people have been here since time immemorial, meaning before memory or since the very beginning. I only start here because it provides relevant context for present day Indigenous agricultural practices and climate justice efforts. So that's why I'm starting with the colonized history of these lands. And this history of colonization is suppressed, falsified, and romanticized within the United States as well as globally, which leads to many issues for Indigenous peoples today, but also for other groups of people. To give an example, most American kids can't name more than three tribes within the United States, and many believe, not just kids, but adults as well, many believe that Indigenous people do not exist today. Textbooks of all grade levels include misinformation that serves to better the image of the US government and colonized history, so there's rarely change that happens. And an important fact to know is that the genocide of Indigenous people would later inspire the Holocaust. Native people have also had their lineage tracked today by the government through blood quantum. And blood quantum was a tool of control used against both Black and Indigenous Americans. So if an individual had even one drop of Black blood, they were considered Black and could therefore be controlled and enslaved. If an individual did not or does not today have enough Native blood, they are considered not Native at all. So they're stripped of that tribal affiliation and Native identity. So Native people are the only group of people subjected to blood quantum today. It's also a practice used for dog and horse breeds. Tribal status is also used to further divide Native people and Indigenous identity. So tribes are politically defined Indigenous identities, but not all Native communities are federally recognized tribes. And that does not make any group or any individual more or less Indigenous. Today, tribal citizens are similar to dual citizens, where they're members of their tribal community as well as US-born citizens. And tribal members need to show proof of ancestry to be enrolled tribal citizens. And this can either be done through blood quantum or physical documentation, which is usually the case. And this image on the right is a picture of my grandfather's grandmother, Mamie Blue Jacket, at Carlisle Indian School, which was the first Indian boarding school. And it was located in Pennsylvania. This photo was taken when she was 15 years old in 1893. And I'll come back to that in just a moment of what the Indian boarding schools are. So I'm not going to go through this entire timeline. Don't worry about trying to remember these dates or the names of these policies. This is just to give a non-extensive overview of some of the ways in which law and policies have taken Indigenous people from their lands. And then on the next slide, law and policies that had goals of cultural genocide, and then some of the more positive actions of providing some basic human rights for Indigenous people in these lands. So, with the goals of dispossession, these were treaties, laws, policies, acts that wanted to remove Indigenous people from their lands. Some of the more notable ones include the Trail of Tears. This was the five, and I quote, civilized tribes, which included the Cherokee, Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creek, Muscogee, and Seminole nations. This was a forced relocation of these tribes to lands in Oklahoma. Over 5,000 Native people died on this journey. And although we talk about the Trail of Tears as this one act, it happened over a significant period of time. And there were many trails across different regions spanning over this time period. We're often only taught about this one. There was an Oregon Trail of Tears. There were similar forced relocations of indigenous peoples in different areas. Some of these other examples that may not necessarily seem like a goal of dispossession would be the establishment of national parks. That's often seen as something that's very positive in the history of the United States. However, these parks, first and foremost, needed to remove indigenous people in order to make these recreational havens, primarily for white people within the United States. So indigenous people, even after being relocated from these lands, could not access these lands and resources and practice land stewardship in these areas. So I'll move on to some of the policies with goals of cultural genocide. These include the Indian boarding schools, for example. And to quote former president, the Indian boarding schools were created to kill the Indian and save the man. And this included kidnapping of indigenous children, forced education, and torture. They wanted to literally beat the culture out of these kids. And bodies of these children are continually found today in unmarked mass graves at boarding schools across the United States, as well as in Canada. And they lasted a very long time. The last boarding schools closed in 1978. So almost all Native families today have had family members who have gone through boarding school process. So if there's anyone listening today who has been affected by that, you're seen. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry that these are hard topics to hear about. Looking towards the more positive actions within the nation's history, we have the Indian Citizenship Act in 1924 is when Native people were first recognized as citizens of the United States. The Freedom of Religion Act also helped to end the U.S. boarding schools and allowed Native people to heal from the boarding school era and begin to actively, more openly, comfortably, and actively practice a religion and culture again. In 1987, we saw the start of the mainstream the environmental justice movement. The mainstream environmental movement, as was mentioned on the previous slide, began in 1960. And the problem with the mainstream U.S. environmental movement is that it focused very much on preservation of lands for recreation, which again was not beneficial whatsoever to indigenous people who are not allowed to be caretakers for the land. So 1987 began the environmental justice movement, which centered Black, Indigenous, and other people of color within the United States to right the many wrongs of the U.S. government and the way that they facilitated land management and created inequities within our communities. And in 1991 was the first National People of Color Leadership Summit. This summit was significant because it recognized and brought to the forefront Black, Brown, and Indigenous people's leadership in protecting our environment and natural places. And during the summit, the 17 principles of environmental justice were drafted and adopted, and these remain relevant today and really lead a lot of environmental justice work across the country. So very briefly, the tribe's legal status with the federal government. Tribes are sovereign nations. So tribal sovereignty is the ability to self-govern. They're like nations of their own. But the U.S. also has federal trust responsibility, and this is the responsibility of the U.S. government to protect tribal treaty rights, land, assets, and resources, as well as to carry out federal law when necessary. Tribal self-determination is the ability and right to determine the future of tribal nations by tribal nations. And government-to-government relations in this aspect mean that both tribes and the U.S. government or any other government nationally have an equal seat at the table and must undergo formal government processes. So to look at where Native people are today within the U.S., these orange areas on the map represent tribal reservation lands, and the darker green an area, the higher the Native population is. So 70% of Natives today live off of reservation lands. Many live in other urban as well as other rural communities. Native populations seem to be the most dense around reservation lands, but are definitely not limited to these areas. And Native people make up about 2% of the U.S. population today. California, Arizona, Texas, and Oklahoma, which I'm not sure if you can see my cursor, but this is California, this one's Arizona, the big one, Texas, and then Oklahoma right above it. Have the highest Native populations. California has the highest Native population of any state, and Oklahoma has the highest percentage of Native residents compared to other residents. And this is all sourced from the U.S. Census Bureau, and I can include a link to this map. It's also interactive if you're interested in learning more about populations in different regions. So today, colonialism continues in every aspect of life for Americans, as well as other colonized nations, through ongoing injustices, as well as the legacy of previous genocidal actions. It's seen in the physical landscape of the country and throughout our society, from sports mascots to appropriative Halloween costumes, and the pervasive lack of education around Native people and Indigenous communities. Today and in history. Although these issues won't disappear anytime soon, waves are being made for positive change. And today there's a focus on cultural revitalization, tribal sovereignty, and decolonization, all of which challenge the colonial norms and share Indigenous worldviews and values. Indigenous communities collaborate with federal, state, and local government agencies, as well as other nonprofits and other groups, on agricultural, climate adaptation, and infrastructure projects to strengthen tribal and Indigenous communities. So there's a slow but vital effort towards healing and reconciliation to move towards a more just future. So speaking of those different ways of knowing, I'll now discuss Indigenous knowledge. So Indigenous knowledge includes Indigenous worldviews, which often center the interconnected or holistic being of all things. It's about understanding of relationships between all beings and is passed through stories of our elders and practiced through religion, spirituality. It's intergenerational through ceremonies, traditional practices, cultural norms, storytelling, including songs and sharing memories, oral histories, preserve life before colonization and provide knowledge to face the future. And some of those examples were shown with the Inuit community of West Canada. Traditional ecological knowledge is the base of all traditional Indigenous environmental understandings. It's also knowledge that goes back many generations, all the way to the first ancestors of the land. It's about the past, present, and future relationships with our more than human relatives, sometimes called our non-human relatives. And that's the land, the water, animals, and plants. And traditional ecological knowledge is typically taught on the land. It's about learning by doing, passed through oral tradition, and through cultural practices. So this is an image I'm hoping can help convey that indigenous worldview. Again, every tribe and indigenous community within the US and beyond have different worldviews and values. So what I'm discussing today are just some similarities that are seen between communities. This graphic is from the Status of Tribes and Climate Change report, which was just released earlier this year. I was a co-author for this report and also created this graphic. So again, I'm really hoping that this conveys the point because that was the goal of it. but the graphic shows the external influences on communities. These can be positive or negative. And the ones that I've included here are guidance from our ancestors, hope for future generations, impacts from climate change, and impacts from colonization. And within the center of the image, you can see the many chapters of the STAC report, but these are also things that help create a community. These include health and well-being, cultural resources, air, water, ecosystems, and biodiversity. Protect in place, community-led relocation when necessary, emergency management, and just other ways to help prepare communities for impacts such as climate change and everything else that life has to throw at us. So one of the questions I was asked to discuss during this presentation is, what can we learn in terms of human-environmental relationships? And as was mentioned in that video, Western management is catching on to the importance and value of Indigenous knowledges that they once sought to erase. Partnering with tribes on projects to improve ecosystem quality, such as dam removal efforts and habitat restoration that's more adaptable for climate change, also meets the cultural expectations of tribes. This can mean having more materials for basketry or improving stream flow for more fish. That people would otherwise harvest. We never harvest all of the fish, but do it sustainably where the population can continue to live and thrive and grow. So now I'll move on to agricultural practices, Indigenous agricultural practices with the understanding of that Indigenous worldview. So again, plants are included in our more than human or non-human relatives. I shared a picture of myself from a corn maze a couple of years ago to show tami or corn in Shawnee language. And an example from my tribe, many Shawnee ceremonies are tied to the agricultural cycle. We have a spring bread dance at planting time. We have a green corn dance when the crops ripen, and an autumn bread dance to celebrate the fall harvest. Many Native people are removed from traditional homelands, and rights to accessing lands have been taken away, as formerly mentioned. So it can be very difficult to continue and reestablish agricultural practices in the ways that communities would like to see them. So oftentimes, it can still look a lot like that Western type of agriculture, European type of agriculture, such as the corn rows here, where it's a monocrop. And there's one soil type and one type of management for that kind of land. But that holistic worldview and resilience allows us to adapt and to continue to challenge those expectations and return a lot of our Indigenous ways of knowing and practices for agriculture. So within agriculture, some of the threats today include pesticides and chemical treatments, big ag or large industrial agriculture, monocrops, and capitalism. All of these things impact social, economic, and environmental factors very, very greatly and very deeply within our systems. Indigenous solutions are beneficial because they're organic. They improve the carbon cycle. They restore soil. They focus on biodiversity that need to be protectors of our seeds and keep them within our food systems. It also meets cultural needs and, of course, is interconnected in their view of how to approach systems. And another important point is that agriculture is not only about crops. For Indigenous people, it's really about land stewardship. This includes tending for forests, rivers, grasslands, and other ecosystems and ecosystem functions. So some of the differences between conventional agriculture and Indigenous agricultural practices, again, are that they're holistic approach. This means being the stewards of the land and managing many different landscapes. It's about generations of lived knowledge, traditional ecological knowledge, and the cultural significance of being stewards for the land, of tending to the land. It's about the relationship with land, water, plants, and wildlife, the relationships with our more than human relatives. Indigenous people across the globe protect 80% of the world's biodiversity, and this is because of these factors, because of the holistic approach, because of the generations of lived knowledge, and that cultural relationship with the landscape. Another question I was asked to discuss is the ways in which Indigenous agriculture line up with the Sustainable Development Goals, the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And as you may have already guessed, because it is so holistic in approach, it really addresses all of them, nearly all of them. I could probably give a separate presentation about each individual one and the ways in which Indigenous agricultural practices can meet each of these Sustainable Development Goals. For the sake of time, I don't want to go into it much, but I included the picture here of each of those goals and a link in case you want to access that at a later time and read more from the UN's website. So now I'm moving on to Indigenous climate leadership. So an important note is that climate impacts are threat multipliers. And that means that the problems that are already here are getting worse because of climate change. And one of the main forces facing climate change is the environmental justice and climate justice movements. Again, these are led by Black, Brown, Indigenous people and aim to dismantle the flawed environmental policies that have long harmed and marginalized communities. And again, it's not just Indigenous people that are leading these efforts, but Indigenous people were the first because we were the first people of this land. And the fight against climate change really began when colonization began. It's about protecting the land. Even though we didn't really know the issues of climate change yet, and they hadn't really become an issue yet, it's all about environmental justice and later climate justice. Tribes are among the greatest risk, most impacted communities for climate impacts, and again, have been fighting it since colonization began. Some of the globally recognized climate efforts in the United States include Standing Rock, or the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Although there's no longer a camp and occupation of the lands, this is still an ongoing legal process. And there's a lot of other issues happening right now as well. Although it was the most globally recognized, it was not the end. There's currently a stand against the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota that spans across Canada and the United States. This month, there was a sit-in at the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the National Capital demanding land back, returning a land to indigenous peoples, to become stewards for the land again, to care for the land, to be able to have the right to access lands and resources. There's fights along the southern border of our nation because these border walls have divided communities and are having other environmental impacts on the area as well, as well as the human rights issues involved with the southern border wall. And then there's also many efforts to undam dams, especially the Klamath Dam in California has been one that's been more, at least nationally, recognized. There's many other efforts that are happening now for Indigenous climate and environmental action. And so it's really important to continue to amplify those efforts and learn more about them and talk to your friends about them. So some additional questions that I've been asked. This one was really hard for me to think of, but what must not be missing for a socio-ecological transformation? And my answer to that is that for a true socio-ecological transformation, we have to prioritize frontline communities. They're already doing the work. Indigenous people and other frontline communities are doing the work. We have to continue to amplify those efforts to provide resources for them to fully realize their vision and meet their goals. We also have to restructure the approach nationally and globally to environmental issues. We have a lot of environmental climate focused summits, but whose voices are actually being heard? Who's on the podium? And who are the decision makers here? Are they actually listening to diverse voices? Are they listening to frontline communities? Or are they a lot of the same people who have honestly a lot of talk and not a lot of action? We have to really focus on systemic change. And we have to do so in a way that includes all voices. Another question was, what gives me hope and motivation for my work and commitment? So in my work, like I mentioned, I graduated college just last year with my double bachelor's. While I was a student, I was working my entire undergrad as well, but I still consider myself very new in that professional sphere. And during the past couple of years, I've seen the resilience of Indigenous people, the successes of Native leadership on the front of environmental change, which again improves all aspects of our community for all people. Tribal work is not self-serving, it benefits everyone. And I've been truly inspired by other young people who are bringing together their generational knowledge with new technology to create change. I've also seen really strong and passionate collaborative work between agencies. And that can include federal agencies with tribes. It's been a lot of grassroots activists, people who are on the ground, on the front lines, demanding change and have collaborated with other nonprofits or environmental groups. That's looked a lot of different ways, but it's still amazing to see all of that collaborative work. And I've also seen a lot of interest in these topics globally. Just me being here and being able to present today to all of you in Germany is amazing. I'm so glad that there's interest for this and desire to get involved, to help, and to learn more about these topics. Some other quick examples of tribal climate actions. These are all based in the Pacific Northwest, but I just want to reiterate that it's not just environmental efforts for climate action. It's about infrastructure, economic opportunity, cultural preservation and revitalization. It's about human health, and then planning and adaptation for the future of climate impacts as well. So the Cowlitz tribe, for example, have a strong focus on economic revitalization in their tribal climate action plans. The Puyallup are working on raising salmon to feed orcas and grow their elk reserve. All Pacific Northwest tribes gather annually for a canoe journey. That hasn't happened recently due to COVID, but that's another strong connection with the land and cultural practice that has continued for quite some time. Regionally, as well as nationally, there's also a huge focus on youth engagement and youth leadership efforts. There's culturally appropriate education, there's tribal colleges and universities within the United States, as well as culturally appropriate job programs and other resources such as healthcare and other things too that again focus on human health planning. And if we go back to that graphic earlier from the STAC report, really meets all of the needs and all of the things that make up a community. So now I want to briefly discuss some ways that you can continue to amplify Indigenous action, and then some ways that you can continue to learn about all of the amazing work that's being done by tribes and being done collaboratively with Indigenous communities. So first, we have that map that we started out with, native-land.ca. You can learn about Native nations in the US and beyond, learn about the language, territories, treaties of Indigenous people. And again, that's a growing resource. You can also educate yourselves on the successes as well as hardships of Indigenous communities. There's usually too much focus on all of the hardship, on the ways where Indigenous people have had to survive and overcome and remain resilient. But there's so much Indigenous joy and success that has happened as well. So really focusing on the successes and all the amazing things that have happened, are happening, and will happen is very important. Include Indigenous science in policy making. I know not a lot of you might be involved in policy, but including Indigenous science in the papers that you're writing too, in the kind of research that you want to do, it's also a very important factor. And there's a lot of resources out there, and I'll get to those in a moment. Support Native-owned or Indigenous-owned brands. A lot of Native artists and creators will ship internationally. So this holiday season, can consider buying some Native created products and artwork. Another really important one, this I should have maybe put first, but call out appropriation, prejudice, and injustices. This is so, so important. In order to make change, we have to stop the wrongs first. Cultural appropriation, if you don't know, is the taking from another culture without permission and reducing history, art, spirituality, rituals, reducing all of that to mere fashion or toys. And an example that I've seen in Germany are the Indiana camps or a performance of traditional Native powwows. They are cultural appropriation. And there is a huge difference between cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation. Another way to amplify Indigenous actions is to understand that these are issues that go well beyond what I can describe within this time limit, within this presentation. So it's up to you to further that knowledge following today's presentation and continue to educate yourself on the ways to further amplify Indigenous actions and support Indigenous people. I'd also like to mention that these aren't just concepts. These are real people. We're real people, and these things are happening. That might seem silly to say, but it really is not known by a lot of people. It really flies under the radar. Indigenous people need allies globally to further our efforts for human rights and environmental wellness. And lastly, follow native influencers. Get on whatever social media platform you prefer. And just search and find other Indigenous creators or Native American creators. There's a lot of people who share educational resources, a lot of people who share art. Don't just follow Native influencers for culture that they want to share. We're very often, our cultural practices are appropriated, are taken, or are discussed or shared out of context, or there's a lot of misinformation around it. So following Native influencers can be a big part of finding that deeper understanding and then sharing that information appropriately from the source. So lastly, some resources. I won't go over these in depth, but again, these slides will be sent out. I am still working on these as well. There will be more resources, but I have some written resources and some video resources for you to access to learn more. And thank you all, Niawe, so much for listening to this presentation. And I am more than happy to answer questions that you all may have.